Hey everyone, just wanted to make a quick note. At about 17 minutes in, my power went out, and so I had to scramble to get connected via my phone, and we were able to continue with the episode. But there is a little bit of a break, and then I brought us back into talking. Thanks so much for listening, and here's the episode. Hey everyone, welcome to Fat Theory Book Club. As always, I'm Amanda Levitt, and with me today is Andrea Nevins, the author of the book, The Embodiment of Disobedience, Fat Black Women's Unruly Political Bodies. And they are also the dean of the Farquhar Honors College and a professor of English at Nova Southeastern University. Andrea, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Amanda. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, I was so excited when you said yes, because I, as I told you a little bit before I started recording, I wanted to do this because I love books, but so much of my own understanding of my own body was happening right around the time that you wrote this book. And because I graduated high school in 2004 and, you know, so like on one hand, I love this book because you talk about like musical artists that I know, love Jill Scott, particularly, and Missy Elliott. But, you know, also I love this book because it really does challenge a lot of the dominant understandings of beauty and really subverts a lot of those discussions by not talking about whiteness. I mean, you are talking about whiteness, obviously, but you're centering Black fat women's experience. And I think that is, I mean, and you know, the last book that we read was Fearing the Black Body by Sabrina Strings. And my guest, Rawia Tariq. This is what I did last time. We're going to get through that again. Rawia Tariq. We talked about how a lot of that book really focused on what white men think about Black people. And I really wanted to kind of shift us back to not doing that. Because so much of my upbringing as an academic was starting with those Susan Bordeaux and other, I mean, you talked about Naomi Wolf in your book and really, again, centering on white women's experiences. And I'm just so happy to have a text that shockingly came out in 2006, but I feel like should have a central role in the way that like fat studies scholars are really thinking about fatness as deeply embedded in anti-Blackness and how it functions, you know, globally, not just as something in the West.
Absolutely. So, I mean, my interest in the book certainly grew out of my own embodiment and interest in understanding how folks perceived bodies that looked like mine. You know, growing up in Jamaica, I was an avid reader, and I enjoyed the Nancy Drews, the Bobbsey Twins, all of those were imported, and that's what we had on our shelves. And you know, while I was in high school, we began to see more sort of books for, you know, set in the Caribbean with people of color, but not as many as you would imagine, given that it is Jamaica, a country in the Caribbean. And I remember, Amanda, in reading Nancy Drew had a butler who was Black. And as I read, I would just sort of wait for any moment where the butler would turn up. And at the time, I didn't have an understanding of why. But, you know, as I became an academic, I started realizing I wanted to see how I fit into Nancy Drew's world. And that butler was sort of the closest thing, you know, to sort of give me that sense. So anyway, fast forwarding many years to me deciding to become an academic, I was just sort of naturally drawn to representations of fatness, of Blackness, of femaleness, and really interested in the way how all those forms of embodiment intersected and what that intersection reveals to us.
Yeah, I mean, this is a beautiful book. I hope many people have told you that, but I think it, like, the one thing that I really appreciate is really how you break down. I mean, I'm a sociologist, so I have to, you know, mention Patricia Hill Collins's Matrix of Domination. And I think that it is a really interesting look. You know, I normally go in order when I'm talking to an author, but I did, you know, in this, I think that the first chapter, when you talk about the mammy and specifically the text that you were reading, the wind gone. Yeah, yes. I was like, I always get it out of order because you're so used to hearing Gone with the Wind, which is not what it is. It's a parody of that, quote unquote. But I think that it's a really interesting, discussion about how power is sometimes a really hard thing to put a pin on or to put a finger on and be like, well, this person has power and this person doesn't, because we see this character, Mammy, that's the person's name, really, yes, being a person that was enslaved, but also understanding what that position meant and trying to use it in a way that I felt like was like trying to use it in their favor. And I think that it was a really interesting, you know, kind of flipping that script on a book like Gone with the Wind and all of that discussion about it, on top of the fact that it's like, you know, all of that is erasing, really trying to minimize what slavery was and the harm that was caused by it. I mean, we're seeing this now with the attacks on critical race theory and other things. But I thought that that was, for me, probably like the most interesting thing to read, because I hadn't read that book yet, which I am going to. But I think that it was a really great kind of look into how power is obviously structurally, systematically, it is maybe a little bit easier to pin down. But when we're talking about in those interpersonal interactions, how is power functioning and how do you try to wield power to survive? It becomes a very different conversation.
It does. And, you know, what becomes interesting for me also is sort of in the time since writing the book, looking at newer iterations of the mammy figure that didn't necessarily end up being discussed in the book. So I am a fan of the Matrix trilogy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have seen them.
I have. I haven't seen it in a little bit. So I'm not a...
Right. It's been a while.
Don't know it by the back of my hand or anything.
Yeah. So, you know, I would see someone like the Oracle figure, a curvy Black woman, certainly as a mammy figure. She's light skinned, but functions in many ways, you know, a kind of caregiver, this responsibility for the well-being of many, that sort of thing. There was a movie, I think it came out after the book, with Queen Latifah, and she, what's the name of it? She was the nanny for a white family.
And
it's just right there. And, you know, that's an interesting way in which you see some negotiations with regards to power also. But I think historically, groups of people who have been marginalized have had to find ways from within their state of marginalization to operate subvertly often, to exercise some degree of power. It's not, you know, I think we have an understanding, I think a very white understanding of power, which is like, there is a force that supports you. There is the ability to punish, to get what you want. There is, you know, it's power in that way. But I think in many marginalized communities, certainly among Black women, there's a very different kind of power that you see that doesn't have an army behind it, doesn't have, you know, sort of the justice system, you know, at your disposal, but you find ways nevertheless to try and get things to kind of go your way. And that's a part of what you see with that mammy figure. But I think it's very representative of the way how many women in marginalized communities have operated for centuries, really.
Yeah, I mean, I was also thinking about, and I may have heard this on Twitter because I am an avid Twitterer, but I, you know, because we've had the, you know, Aunt Jemima figures and other ones that are kind of being, you know, being called out and changed to get them out of being media figures and being dehumanized in that way. But we've started to see a lot of Black actresses, particularly being cast as therapists. So there is this kind of like emotional caregiving that, so they're still being kind of placed into this role that feels kinder, it feels nicer, you know, because you're not, it's not subjugation. Someone is, you know, they're going into an office. This is a person that is, you know, is a professional, but then all the people that they're talking to are white people about their white feelings. And it's like this very distinct, you know, very, very distinct thing that I am seeing. I know that there, yeah, there was a couple different ones. I can't remember like the specific examples that I saw on Twitter, but I've definitely seen it in a couple different ways. And I think that, you know, a really good example of that, like, I think that expectation of Black women, particularly fat Black women, of being caregivers, of being the secondary, of being not the main characters, is really part of that, that subjugation and that, you know, dehumanization. And I mean, you talked about desexualization and all these other things as well. And it's, yeah, it is really interesting how, even though we have these, like, you know, we get rid of Aunt Jemima, but we then turn to, okay, well, Black actresses can be therapists. That's okay.
Yes, there is a, I think it's HBO that has a show that started last year with a curvy Black woman as, you know, a therapist. And I think even with that example that I gave of the Oracle figure, I mean, the fate of the world of Zion really rests on, you know, on the Oracle and on identifying her. And again, you know, the responsibility for others being the focus as opposed to responsibility for yourself. Some have argued also that a part of Oprah's appeal, particularly when she was fuller figured, was because she evoked that sort of mammy-esque kind of a figure, someone who's a caregiver. And one of the things that I recall, and I think I write about in the book, is that when she had that first really significant weight loss, her ratings went down. And you would say, well, why would that happen, you know, if she's still doing the same thing? But I think it had to do with people's comfort with her as what would be kind of a more Western vision of sex, of female sexuality, and something about that was off-putting to some of her readers. And I think that's just fascinating, really.
Yeah, Oprah has forever fascinated me, particularly Nadi. I mean, you know, I was thinking about the fact that when you were, you know, when this book got published, and obviously you finished your dissertation far before the book got published, but I was thinking about, you know, in the early 2000s was really when a lot of weight loss companies specifically started targeting the Black community. You know, you started having SlimFast and Weight Watchers and other things really focusing on, you know, and blaming Black motherhood, particularly for the, you know, the rise of the childhood obesity epidemic and other things. And you started to see, you know, Mariah Carey and Jennifer Hudson's and all of these other Black female celebrities that were coming and taking up that position to really try to, you know, again, bring Black community into that fold. And so it's interesting because, you know, obviously now Oprah owns part of Weight Watchers. That's now WW. And so it's been really interesting, her positionality and her relationship to the diet industry and how it is really very much about her kind of being the best like Black friend that people can turn the television and watch, but they don't really necessarily see her as a full person.
Yeah, you know, she actually gave a great example many years ago on one of her shows, and she was talking about she had a farm somewhere like in some rural part of Illinois that she would go like on the weekends, something like that. And she had sheep, and her neighbor had sheep. And so I think the story that she was conveying was that the sheep start off Black, but then become white. But her sheep were not turning white. And she said to her neighbor, oh, maybe that's because she's Black. And the neighbor said, oh, you're not Black. And and she was, you know, sharing this with the audience as, you know, certainly an interesting moment in, you know, the consideration of how we construct race. But I think it reflects what you were just saying, that there is an erasure of race that happens mm-hmm. with her in many circles that allows sort of people to feel sort of more connected to her in some ways, white people, maybe even some Black people. Yeah.
Yeah. In the intro of the book, which I really loved, you talked about the Venus of Wallendorf, which I didn't send you the graphics, but I use that as the graphic on the podcast. And part of it is because as you talked about in the book, that there's so much erasure of the actual like historical origins of the Venus of Wallendorf. I mean, just the fact, and touche on your part, because I never even thought about it, but like the fact that it's called a Venus really places a signifier of it being a white person's body. And I know that I've seen like speculation about, well, maybe it was someone that was like looking down at themselves and that's how they saw their body. And so that's what they did. And not like you can like look at another person. This is like, this is like the silliest speculation I've ever heard. I mean, I remember when people used to speculate that we did it, the sun didn't give us light, but that we opened our eyes and there was like beams of light coming out because science, you know. I think about all of these weird ways that we speculate about things. And instead of just acknowledging the historical roots of a figure and thinking about, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think part of it is because people don't want to think that, you know, Black folks were the, you know, the original settlers of Europe, probably. I'm sure many of it is that. But I loved that portion of the book.
And apart from that, even aside from, you know, who was where, when.
Yeah. So let's continue talking about the Venus of Wallendorf, I guess.
Yeah. So I think I was saying that, you know, a part of the rejection of her identity is not only in terms of just, you know, could Black people have been around at that point in time and could have been, you know, settled living in parts of Europe, Austria, where she was created. But I think it's also the idea that anyone would think that the curvy Black body was a figure worth creating or inspiring a piece of art. And I think that's part of the, you know, sort of some of the turmoil around her and the question of erasing her identity.
Yeah, that is such a good point. Particularly since, you know, throughout this entire book, you do such a good job of talking about the ways that the fat female Black body is, you know, really denigrated and treated as, you know, the antithesis to whiteness, and really, you know, dehumanized, desexualized. I mean, pretty much everything across the board and not have, you know, yes, that's such a good, you're blowing my mind for a sec. But yes, I think that it is such a great point. But for me, it was, you know, again, I really appreciated, you know, you taking the time to describe the Venus of Wallendorf. And, you know, obviously it's the origins of where it came from and the time that it came from, but even the connection to the type of name and how it, you know, again, a Venus really brings forth thinking about like Roman and Greek gods and like all of that type of stuff, and really does create this idea that the statue is recreated as the antithesis to Blackness. And yeah, it was, I really loved that part of the book, and I thought that it was really important, particularly, you know, again, as I said, the graphic for this podcast has the Venus of Wellendorf, and part of the reason I chose it to be there is because there is so much that is spoken about the Venus of Wellendorf, while also at the same time ignoring its origins and ignoring the reality of who it represents and who it doesn't at the same time.
For sure. I don't know if you have come across it, but a couple of years ago, an organization, it goes by the acronym DIS. I can't remember what it stands for, but they have an online platform with all kinds of really amazing works of art, digital works of art. And they reached out to me to ask, they wanted to do an animated version of the Venus of Willendorf, speaking as an art piece that would be on display at a particular museum. Have you come across that?
I haven't, but that sounds amazing.
Yeah, and so they asked me to write the dialogue and to voice it and to do the recording for it. And so what it is really the Venus of Willendorf animated, sort of speaking to an audience in a museum, presumably explaining who she is. And so for me doing it, I couldn't help but to think of it as a woman with some kind of like a Caribbean accent with, you know, and so you get this Venus of Willendorf figure in my voice, but using kind of Caribbean patois, explaining her origins and who she is. I'll look for the link and send it to you. Or if you do a search and you just do Venus Monologues, DIS, you'll find it. So you may find that interesting. It was fun and interesting to do it.
That sounds so cool. It sounds awesome for you to be your voice and being able to, you know, have, you know, really kind of like help the Venus reclaim its, you know, its origins and make it seem, you know, remind us of the people who made it or the person who made it and why, you know, not even necessarily why it was made, but also, you know, reminding people, just its historical roots. That sounds so cool. I have a background in history in art. And so I'm always really excited when people do really great work like that to, you know, kind of really reclaim lost histories or, you know, erased histories, as you said in the book, which I think is a better way to describe it.
Yeah. And, you know, on the issue of erasure, you know, one piece of research, I mean, a lot of research in doing the book really was just intriguing to me. But one part that was particularly intriguing, and this is in chapter 4, when I talk about performance, was finding out that sort of during that vaudeville era, which had some full-figured white female performers, that there was a particular one that in turning up at, you know, whatever the venue was, because of her size, the coordinators of the performance essentially said, oh, so based on her size, you got to put her in blackface. And I thought, isn't that fascinating? It's almost like that moment in the research or just looking back helps to bring together so much of the theory that was kind of bubbling there and needed to coalesce, you know, that the existence of this white female performer as a full-figured woman, it's almost like to justify her being on stage, there was an erasure of her whiteness. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the state of being black that her body became sort of more acceptable for performance. And that to me is also just a kind of mind-blowing thing, you know?
Yeah, that is so interesting. Particularly because, you know, I mean, just thinking about the performances of blackface and how black women, I mean, black folks in general, but, you know, I mean, I can think of some of the different films with white women in blackface that it, you know, so much of that minstrel like performance was really, you know, over exaggerated, over the top. I mean, to make it as dehumanizing as possible. I mean, you know, and I think that having a, you know, a large fat white lady in blackface just really kind of makes it, you know, leans into the grotesque kind of in a way that, you know, would make it more exciting for like a white audience that is disgusting, but also, yeah, I'm like on one hand, disgusted, but also not surprised. Like,
And I think a part of the acceptability of it is that Black women's bodies, Black bodies in general, Black women, are sort of spectacularized anyway. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the body does not fit sort of Western notions of beauty, inherently those bodies don't because they're Black. But it's sort of like, well, you're already not fitting. So being full figured, you know, doesn't make it that much worse because you're already on the outskirts of the boundaries of mm-hmm. sort of a aesthetic acceptability. And so there is, in a strange way, kind of a more openness to the spectacle of a full-figured Black woman mm-hmm. than there is to the spectacle of a full-figured white woman.
Yeah, that is so interesting. I mean, I would assume it was around, I mean, you talked about the Venus, the Hottentot Venus. And I think that too, I mean, obviously, like, you know, the use of her and, you know, the spectacle that was made of her body, you know, I think is also kind of part of that. And I'm assuming that it was around a similar time. I mean, you can obviously tell me if it was around kind of a similar time, but I would wonder if that was also part of the push. I mean, obviously we know that like anti-fatness and anti-Blackness are, you know, well, anti-fatness is deeply rooted in anti-Blackness. And so there's, you know, obviously that, but I would be interested. It would be interesting to know if they were happening at the same time and how those, you know, how they not necessarily interacted, but how, you know, the people that were putting on this performance and putting this performer into blackface, if they were also, you know, riding on the, you know, the subjugation and, you know, dehumanization of Sarah Bartman. I always forget her last name.
Yes. I think there is a connection to be made. There is a bit of a time mm-hmm. difference. So the vaudeville issue with the performance on the blackface, as I recall, was sort of turn of the century, early 1900s, late 18, coming into early 1900s. Satje Bartman, the Hottentot Venus, as she was called, was late 1700s into early 1800s. But I believe there's absolutely a connection between, you know, the spectacularizing of her mm-hmm. body, and then these comments that come like a century later about the curvy white woman wanting to perform. And, you know, one of the things that I think I may not have discovered until after the book was published, because I don't think it's in there, but The dress style that became popular in British society, and I believe over here in the US as well, where you know, those dresses that would have the I think they refer to it as a bustle, the thing that came under the dress that gave the appearance of you having like a significant derriere, but it was really built into the framing that went under, you know, dresses of that time, that it was in part inspired by the spectacle of the Venus Hottentot.
Oh, wow.
And her, you know, significantly larger derriere than, you know, the typical European woman. And that in itself also becomes fascinating. And you think, well, what's the connection there now to some of what you see currently with women, white women primarily, but not only, trying to get the enhancements to their butts to make their butts, you know, a little bigger. And I think the two are inevitably connected. And it's sort of like, even though there's this marginalization of these bodies of Black women because of the concurrent hypersexualization, there's a way in which communities that don't identify with this, these women still want to borrow from the hypersexualization in a perhaps moderated kind of way. I don't know if I'm just making that up, but I think that's some of what is happening.
I don't think you're making it up either. I have definitely thought about it, particularly, you know, it's the BBL, the Brazilian butt lift, that I just recently read something that it's like the number one like plastic surgery in the world.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And particularly, you know, because it's, I mean, Brazil has had, you know, its own colonialist history and has this long history of plastic surgery and the construction of whiteness there. But I think that it is, I think, you know, the, now on one hand, the bustle that you were talking about, the only thing that I think is cool about that is that it created pockets so that they could like store stuff in them, which is the only thing that's nice, because we all know that then they just like ripped pockets away from all women's clothing after that. But because, you know, women weren't, once we got into, you know, the Enlightenment, women weren't allowed to have books, white women particularly, but Black women as well. I mean, all Black folks, if they were enslaved. But, you know, I do think that it is, I mean, this is part of like white tradition, is taking from marginalized communities and finding some way or another to ascribe it to ourselves and use it, but also control it. Because I think I've had this conversation, I've had people ask questions if, you know, if fat phobia is actually, you know, or anti-fatness is getting, it's getting better, you know, or that it's lessening, because now we have Lizzo's and we have, you know, Nicole Byer, both these people that I absolutely adore, but also I think they are like the anomaly to the reality, which is that, yes, we have BBLs, but there is still this very specific type of embodiment that is, you know, that is still a controlled body. So yes, you have a BBL, but you are still fit, you know, fit in the, your body doesn't move. You don't have any jiggling. You don't have cellulite. You don't have dimples or stretch marks or anything else that makes you look like a human. Instead, you have this very controlled body that is expected of you. And so like your butt's bigger, you know, but otherwise it's not the same, you know, it's not a quote unquote natural body. It's a, you know, enhanced body, which like folks can go get BBLs all they want, but it's still, you know, thinking about that historical reality and like, you know, colonialism is pretty important.
Yeah, for sure. I think that the issue that issues around proportionality, still have a significant role in how we identify beauty. And so, I mean, you can take the same face on multiple women, but that proportion of, you know, hip to waist to bust and so on, has a huge role in sort of determining how they would be ranked in terms of white Western beauty aesthetics. And that is interesting. And, you know, I mean, you're starting to see like some of the online boutiques buck that a little by having bodies that are shaped in different ways, you know, pear-shaped bodies and, you know, apple-shaped bodies and so on. But we're still very much invested in sort of something along the lines of, you know, the kind of proverbial Coca-Cola bottle shape being the ideal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I very much do not, like, I don't consume most media, but like, I think the thing that's interesting to me is, you know, when we're thinking about someone like Kim Kardashian, like she is, yes, she has a big butt, but she is still a very small person. She is still incredibly thin. And so I think that, yes, that proportionality is so important and is still pushed in, you know, in all reaches of not just American society, but most industrialized nations and particularly Western nations. You know, I think, and I can't remember if in 2006 when the book came out, but I know, I mean, the reach of the obesity epidemic and like, and all of the people that are benefiting from capitalism because of that, you know, quote unquote, issue is that, you know, they are, it's going global, like colonialization is being pushed through this, you know, quote unquote epidemic. And, you know, what we are seeing in mainstream, you know, media is this, again, as you said, proportionality and this very specific, you know, enhancement of the body, but it's still like a very thin person with that enhancement of their body. It's not a fat person. Like it's not, you know, it is, I don't know, it's a very distinct body type that we're talking about.
For sure. You know, and a part of what I, you know, suggest in the book is that this sort of rejection, it's that what has taken place is not a wholesale rejection of fatness, but it's a very narrow appreciation of fatness only when it is specifically placed in certain areas on the slender body. So if you have a full bust or a full butt on a slender body, that type of fatness is okay. But if the body itself is full figure, then that becomes, you know, highly problematic.
Yeah. And that kind of leads, you know, we're going a little topsy-turvy through the book, but I, you know, I loved that you talked about beauty pageants in part because I was in beauty pageants as a child in the late 80s, early 90s. So it wasn't quite toddlers and tiaras where it is now, but it still was this very, I mean, interesting experience from my perspective, especially as a little white girl and like, but also very much interesting in my perspective as a scholar now, because there is that place as a white fat person where you can ascribe to and get closer to that white feminine ideal. And I really liked that you took the time to kind of talk about all of these different ways that Black women had to ascribe to whiteness to get through these beauty pageants and how there were uproars over that, you know, and not just like the way your body looks, but also the type of English that you're speaking instead of, you know, using African-American vernacular English or using, you know, you're supposed to use like proper English and you have to use, if you have a talent, it has to be a very specific talent. Yeah, that I thought was a really great part of the book.
Yeah. And, you know, it's painful for me as a Black woman, you know, who grew up in Jamaica, to look at Jamaica's own history with beauty pageants and to see just the very stark ways in which we idealized whiteness and marginalized Blackness in a country where the majority of people are at least in part of, you know, African origin. And, you know, in the book, I spoke about the evolution of beauty contests in Jamaica. And I know when people hear this, they'll think it is bizarre, but, you know, in the initial beauty contests that we had earlier part of the 1900s, I think probably 1930s, somewhere around there we started, all of the women who were winning were white, or at least presented as white. And then eventually, in response to, you know, outcries about, you know, the contest not being representative enough, they created multiple contests that were named according to complexion. So you had, you know, ebony and jasmine and, you know, sort of reflecting the different racial groups. And I think just a part of all of what this says is that these beauty contests and who is selected as the winner is they're really indicative of the values held by a particular culture, or at least the person's power in that culture.
Yeah, I mean, I know early beauty pageants in the U.S. I think you talked about one in Delaware, I think it was.
Yes, Rehoboth Beach. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that they used to like measure body parts, and that's how they decided who was the most beautiful, which I think was, I mean, wild, but also, you know, it really, who, you know, I always think about who's made that scale to decide what is beautiful, and then the fact that you're, you know, deciding based on inches, and who gets to have that title. I mean, you know, knowing that it's Delaware, like Black women weren't even probably allowed to enter, you know, that pageant, or if they were, they, you know, their application didn't get anywhere. You know, but the way that it turns into this very, you know, I don't know, like, it's just like it's just, you know, treated as this like science project that they have to figure out, and not really about the reality that like beauty is bullshit. And I mean, obviously it's a beauty pageant. They're not going to just come out and be like, beauty is bullshit, you're all beautiful. Like that just wouldn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, but that's such a telling statement, you know, I mean, so reflective. I mean, this whole beauty contest thing, it is bullshit.
Oh yes.
I remember years ago speaking with, I guess I was talking about, probably this was back when I was in grad school, talking about, you know, perhaps my research on this chapter. And I had a girlfriend who, she didn't really do much with watching TV and that kind of thing. And I was talking to her about it, and she was just like, what? We're still having beauty contests? And I was like, yes. And she was like, that is just crazy. And at the time, as much as I was doing this work, I had not really stepped back to fully sort of embrace the idea that these contests are bizarre, that in this modern age, we're still saying to women, come, let's judge and see who is the most beautiful. But, you know, you saying that a while ago just reminded me, you know, it is just ridiculous that, you know, we try, and are we doing this with men? I mean, you have the bodybuilding, but nothing that equates to, you know, typical beauty contest.
Yeah, there is a Tonight with John Oliver episode where on HBO where he talked about the Miss America pageant, because they know he did a really good deep dive. It was pre-Trump. And I know that because he makes a really good joke about Trump. I would show it when I talked about gender when I was teaching. And he starts off by talking about that it's a measuring contest, but I won't like ruin the end for you, but like they, you know, he talks about how that Miss America as an organization is the largest supplier of scholarships for women to go to college, like, which is utterly horrific, particularly when we're thinking about the ways that, you know, not only is that inherently privileging, you know, white femininity,
yeah,
very specifically, but also the fact that like women don't just get scholarships for like being good at stuff. Instead, they have to ascribe to this very specific standard of beauty. And it's that, to me, has always been such a just a wild thing to think about, that it's like 2022. And yeah, it's just so, it feels like such a foreign thing when we are like thinking about what we probably should be doing in 2022. And it's not beauty pageants.
No, it's not. And I mean, to me, it feels like they have diminished just because I don't pay any attention to them. But I guess they're still out there. I mean, I have no clue from year to year who is Miss America, Miss Jamaica, any of those things for the most part. Although some years ago, maybe now it's as much as a decade, we did in Jamaica have a dark-skinned woman who with dreadlocks who became a Miss Jamaica. And that did catch my attention and other people's attention, because that is not typical of our Miss Jamaicas, although it's slowly starting to change.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's gotten, I know with like child beauty pageants, because I didn't experience this. The only thing I remember, because I was maybe 4 or 5, is getting on stage and crying. So like, I was very bad at it. Like, I do still have my book of photos, and I was like 4 or 5 and like very sexualized as a small child, which is wild and terrifying. But it has gotten, you know, these kids are getting like dental implants and wearing, you know, they're not kids, they're, you know, little porcelain dolls that go on stage, basically. And yeah, I think it's so fascinating to think about. But I also just really loved that example, because it just really kind of broke down how, like, what is this, you know, understanding of what white femininity is, and how do Black women, if they want to be in those white spaces, how much they have to change who they are, on top of like already having like a genetic composition of what their body looks like, but then also having to change their, you know, as I said, their, you know, how they talk and what their hair looks like, and you know, and even the type of talent they had. I mean, I know you mentioned, you know, one of the contestants was worried about being a Black girl singing Whitney Houston, because they thought that would negatively impact the score. Yeah, which is like, particularly with like Whitney Houston, but also just, you know, yeah, just very wild. I keep saying wild.
Well, that is a good word to use. You know, what has been interesting, and something that I have not, you know, looked closely at, is over the past decade or so, when I have glimpsed, like, you know, little news articles on Miss Americas, Miss USAs, and so on, there's an increasing number of women of color who seem to be in these positions. Mm-hmm. There is, from my quick recall and not any kind of scholarly study, a sort of similarity in look between them, particularly in terms of hair. My recollection is that just about all of them have long hair that kind of approximates flowing white hair. And so that has been interesting. But I haven't looked closely, and I think just observing how that the winners of those contests evolve, mm-hmm, will be very telling about, you know, us as a culture.
Yeah, I could talk to you forever, but there was one thing that I want to talk about, kind of blending together the last two chapters, because, and also kind of, let's bring Oprah back into this. You know, thinking about, because I was thinking about it when I was reading the book and thinking about, you know, Black women's sexuality, but then also the positionality of Black women in the media. I mean, I know you talked about Ma Rainey and, you know, Jill Scott, Missy Elliott, and some other women, and their, you know, kind of position in music and in performance spaces. But I also think it's really interesting for me that I have always thought about, I mean, particularly now, I really love, even though I'm 36, I really love Doja Cat and Megan Thee Stallion. And, you know, I really appreciate that as someone that studies sexuality, that there is, that they really are the antithesis of this very white hegemonic expectation of what sexuality is supposed to be. And particularly with Megan Thee Stallion, I probably need to lengthen my the. but, you know, I really appreciate that there has been, for her specifically, it's been really interesting to watch and see how people respond to her overt sexuality while she also at the same time is like talking about how important it is. Like the reason that she wanted to write the song WAP, which stands for wet ass pussy, was because she found out that a lot of women don't understand that wetness when you're turned on is normal. And so she wanted to write a song about it. And I think that that is like such an inherently like political thing about being able to like teach people to not just embrace their sexuality, but have control over it. It's such a really interesting thing that I'm watching. And I feel like, I mean, this has been a tradition of Black women that I remember from even the 90s with like Salt-N-Pepa and TLC. And I could just mention all these other people, but like, I don't know, it's just really interesting to kind of think about that it is about performance, but also like, what is the cultural archetype that really allows us to kind of think more freely about sexuality and having control over it and breaking down a lot of stereotypes at the same time?
Yeah, so I think that one of the ways in which, you know, women, Black women across the diaspora have resisted the policing of their bodies and their sexuality is to, I don't know if the right term is to embrace that hypersexualization, but to sort of step into it without any guilt, without any shame, and to mm-hmm. to from that hypersexualized space, exercise that agency and, you know, advocating, you know, for things that they believe, things that they want from that position. You see this, and I know I keep going back to sort of Jamaican popular culture, but
it's okay.
Yeah, you know, with in the dance hall DJ world, it has been a predominantly male dominated space with, you know, initially very few female DJs. And, you know, the men would DJ about all kinds of things relating to, you know, their sexuality, their prowess in the bedroom, this kind of thing. And then comes along some female DJs who begin commenting in the most raucous ways on male sexuality, on embracing their own sexuality. And it's just been intriguing, you know, mm-hmm. beyond description. And I think that that is just a part of what we're seeing too with, you know, Megan Thee Stallion, that, you know, I guess one of the benefits, I don't know if I even want to call this a benefit, but being marginalized to begin with, you end up being sufficiently far from center that it doesn't become that inconceivable to further step away from center. And I know center is problematic, mm-hmm. but you know what I mean? To further step away and to hold a position that continues to be in even more extreme ways, not acceptable by sort of white mainstream culture, let's say. And, you know, there is lots of problematic things about the way how women's bodies have been policed. I mean, of course, look at all of what's happening now, but even just in terms of what is appropriate and what you can say and do, and there's such disparity compared to you know, the things men are allowed to express about their sexuality and their needs and interests. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's happening. And I've seen it happen in other arenas, and I think it's intriguing.
Yeah. I mean, my Pandora playlist is like a mixture of pretty much everyone that you wrote about in the book. And then like, I just love 90s and like early 2000s hip hop and R&B. And so it's like that. And then that's how I found out about like Doja Cat and Megan Thee Stallion. And I like, there's one line, and I am terrible because I don't remember the name of it, but there's one line where Megan is talking about having sex with a guy, but he wanted to not have sex with a condom. And she was like, yeah, that's, you know, not going to happen. Like, he thought he would get away with that, basically. This is my very white description of what happened. But, you know, it's really interesting. I think particularly when I'm thinking about like very young people listening to this music and knowing that you can, you know, obviously like the dependent upon your class status and where you live and safety and other things, being able to have that agency, it's not necessarily there, but also at the same time, like to me, it still feels like a resistance. It feels like being able to have control, being able to just putting those like little inklings of doubt into people when they're listening to this type of music. And I think that that is like such a, I don't know. I'm just like, it is very interesting, but I'm also just like incredibly excited about that and knowing that it's like out there and that, you know, it's continuing that tradition. Cause you know, I remember, oh, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I just remember like, you know, my first cassette tape that I ever bought was TLC. And I remember, you know, I remember the one song from their first album when they did a music video that they had condoms on their glasses. You know, this was, you know, so out there compared to these very, you know, white Christian ideas of what is acceptable. I mean, happening under the time when, you know, NWA was getting attacked in Congress for, you know, talking about, you know, fuck the police and stuff. And so you have these like very, you know, resistance in so many ways, and having that in the media has always just been really great. And it's, you know, particularly as like a 90s child it's been nice to see that it's like continue to progress. And that tradition kind of like continues as we're, you know, mm-hmm. continuing along into, you know, whatever time period they'll call this.
You know, I mean, when you are limited in your political, legal, you know, economic power, for many of us, it's words that you have, you know, mm-hmm. and it's interesting the way how even where that is concerned, there is such an effort to curtail and to further police. So, mm-hmm. you know, remember, I think this was during like the Clinton years, his Gore's wife, there was a lot of focus on the lyrics of music and on, you know, and I mean, not to say that some of those lyrics, you know, may not be, you know, off-putting to even the most seasoned, you know, person out there who's used to hearing different sorts of people speak, but just the fact that there has been that kind of focus on discussions around race and sexuality and, you know, concerns within the Black community, even though it may be like the most extreme swear words that are used to express mm-hmm. that. And this is the same thing that you're seeing even now with this whole critical race theory thing. I mean, here in Florida, oh my goodness, you know, mm-hmm. You know, you have the don't say gay thing and on this whole focus on, you know, all these ways that you can't provide training that would help people to have certain insights into issues around race and marginalization. And so I think that is the arena of the powerless, the spoken word. Mm-hmm. And there is a definite effort and has been to even limit power in that arena.
Yes.
So yeah, but those who, you know, have the mic, like a TLC and a Megan Thee Stallion, are making use of what opportunity they have to, you know, speak their truth.
Yeah, I, you know, I also think about when, you know, Beyonce, I could talk about this forever. I'm not going to keep you forever talking about this, but I just thought about, you know, the, when Beyonce, you know, released Lemonade and the lead single, she was, you know, riding in a, on top of a cop car and like everyone was pissed. My, all of my dad's friends, when he moved to Florida, became cops, which is horrific to me. And also very not surprising. It's very on brand for him. And, but I think that, you know, I remember how outraged they were at this. And I'm like, do you under, like, I went through and I explained what the lyrics meant. And they were like, oh, because there's just so much anger over words and not, you know, because again, this is just like propaganda and crap, but you know, it really is, as you said, a type of resistance and an ability to like create a cultural understanding, that is, you know, not necessarily for white people, and that is okay. And, you know, I'm always appreciative of, you know, the ways that younger generations of folks are able to kind of continue to be, you know, brought into that tradition by, you know, new artists and other types of performers. And yeah.
But, you know, one of the things I would say that is, you know, inspiring and I guess hopeful, you know, as an administrator at a university, I interact a lot with, you know, just undergrad students, 19, 20 year olds. And my experience with my students is that they are, generally speaking, very concerned about their community, about mm-hmm. their world. You know, we were having a discussion a few months ago about, you know, something that we may pursue that would involve, you know, creating products and selling or buying to fundraise, you know, for students. And, you know, they were raising issues like, you know, we have to think about, you know, making sure that we purchase from minority-owned businesses, and we need to think about the kind of production, the kind of the way how these things are produced, and issues around mm-hmm. the environment. And I thought, wow, that's fantastic. When I was 19, that was not a part of what me and my friends were talking about, you know, as yeah. we were making decisions and having discussions with university officials. You know, it's students on my campus who are pushing the issues around recycling and, mm-hmm. you know, how it is that we are treating the environment. And so it gives me hope that in all arenas where certain issues have not been properly addressed, that that is changing. Not as fast as some of us would like, but mm-hmm. I think it is, and hopefully that's the trajectory we'll continue to be on.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, with the last few weeks, I think all of us are just like mentally burned out with the state of the world in our country. But also, I too have really noticed that, you know, the kids are all right, as they say. I think that there is so much. Same thing. Like I, you know, I found Fat Community very young, but it took me a while to like figure things out. And I didn't know very much about it. And, you know, this past semester I worked in a predominantly white, high school. I was teaching a class off campus in the high school, and just the like level of, competence, but also like interest in activism and interest in being in community with other people and growing social justice movements. It's just like, it's just so beautiful. And it just makes me so hopeful for the future. And I think that, you know, it's, yeah, obviously we're allowed to be internally screaming, but we also can hope that we can like get back to the streets and, you know, support our communities and each other and try to, you know, continue keeping on.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that.
Yeah. And also, I did want to note, I didn't want to interrupt you. I really appreciate that you did talk about your Caribbean ancestry, particularly being from Jamaica, because, you know, as you know, most white people tend to think about Blackness as a monolith. And I think that it is really important to acknowledge that, like, it is very different. I mean, I noticed in, you know, the type of inflections that people use and when they're speaking in the city of Detroit, it is different by area of the city. Like it is a, you know, there are these cultural differences and ethnic differences that I think people don't think about that I think is really important. And that was one reason that I was really excited to dig into your book, because, you know, we think about Blackness and race as a monolith, and we don't think about the way that ethnicity and origin and historical, you know, ancestral experiences are like deeply embedded in Black experience as well.
Certainly. And, you know, coming from, you know, outside of the US and a particular type of culture, it gives me a particular insight into issues around race that are not necessarily that often discussed by broader American society. So coming from Jamaica, a country where the majority is, you know, at least in part of African heritage, of Black heritage, many of the issues that we see here in the US that are firmly sort of understood as having to do with race, it's so clear to me that it significantly has to do with class. And there is just a sort of unwillingness to discuss these issues in terms of class. But when you do that, it unites groups of people experiencing similar challenges and oppressions. It unites them across racial groups when you kind of understand that while race and class are inextricably intertwined, there is a huge element of class that is causing the challenge that a particular group is feeling. And if it were approached perhaps with more emphasis on issues around class, perhaps it could be solved or dealt with a bit more efficiently, even if only in terms of the people who are experiencing the marginalization or the oppression, you know, working together to find solutions.
Yes, I totally agree, you know, and I, I totally agree. I think, you know, your discussion, we're not going to keep rambling through the book, but there are so many points that I could keep talking to you about. But I just want to say, I really appreciate it. Also really appreciate it just because, you know, a lot of times we don't think about the fact that Jamaica and other Caribbean areas were colonized as well. And what does that mean about, you know, the people that lived there then, what was their experiences? And then also, you know, what does that mean for the people that live there now? And I think that is, you know, is so important. But yeah, thank you so much for being here. I totally, totally appreciate it. I was so excited again when you said that you would be on. And also thank you for dealing with the fact that I lost power.
Yeah, listen, it's part of what we have to deal with Zoom and with all, you know, but at the same time, Zoom has opened our eyes to the possibilities that were there before, but somehow weren't fully apparent to all of us. So I fully understand those, you know, challenges, but thank you for having me on. I looked forward to it and I enjoyed chatting with you, and best wishes with your studies and as you continue with the podcast.
As always, thank you so much for listening. Our book next month is In Transit, Being Non-Binary in a World of Dichotomies by Diana E. Anderson. This book just came out
but I believe it's going to be a great read, and I can't wait to talk to Diana about it next month. As always, if you want to ask me a question, troll me, or whatever else, you can do that by emailing me at fattheorybookclub@gmail.com. Talk to you all next month. Bye-bye.